then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more roar for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud walled cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a manly chest was throbbing for the blessed warning light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's November the 29th, 2012. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. I normally don't do TV reviews, and I don't even have cable TV because it's a waste of money, but I saw something the other day that I found very interesting and which I think has a bearing on our situation here at the beginning of the Obama dictatorship. Now, like I said, I don't have cable, but I do have a TV with a DVD player attached, and so I watch a lot of movies when I can get them cheap on Blockbuster coupons and the $5 bin at Walmart, so forth and so on. Now, one of the things I tend to watch is various kinds of cop shows, not just for the mystery aspect, but also because their heroes are people who, in almost every instance, do not deserve to be made into heroes, i.e. FBI agents, cops, and district attorneys. You get the idea. I'm talking about shows like Criminal Minds, Bones, NCIS, Covert Affairs, Warehouse 13, that kind of stuff. I find actual proper cop shows like the original Law and Order, for example, or the really great Hill Street Blues, for those of you old enough to remember, to be a lot less offensive because they're at least somewhat realistic and they offer a much more balanced and truthful portrayal of race. But this business of making feds out to be heroes and noble characters motivated by allure of America, that's horseshit. I watch these shows because they stir my anger to white heat and increase my level of desire to bring this latrine down on everybody's heads, which is probably one of the reasons that my doctors keep telling me I have malignant hypertension. I know what these people do in real life, like fabricating audio tapes to send 65-year-old men to prison, and shooting down mothers holding their babies in their own doorway, and watching their grossly inaccurate and suck-ass portrayal in the Hollywood media serves a definite political and racial purpose in my case. It fuels my rage. I admit, it stokes my fires and re-energizes my batteries to imagine some NVA-style group of the future wiping the smirks off the faces of these actors who are giving these heroic portrayals of people who are basically cowards and bullies and criminals who do horrible things to people for money. Anyway, I'd kind of lost track of NCIS, Navy Criminal Investigation Service, the show about the Navy feds. It's actually not very good, and I think the only reason it's lasted 10 seasons is because of one of the lead characters, who is a quote-unquote beautiful Israeli Mossad agent, who somehow gets assigned to investigating American naval cases with an American federal agency as a quote-unquote liaison, which is something that may actually occur, given how far the United States government has its nose stuck up Israel. Ass. Interestingly, the allegedly beautiful Israeli is played by a Chilean mestizo. I guess they couldn't find a Jewish actress who could last 10 seasons without going all dumpy and blousy and Golda Meir on them. Anyway, a comrade mentioned something about the latest plotline of the series and got me curious, so I went to my computer and I watched the last two episodes of season 9, including the cliffhanger where the NCIS office gets blown up, and the first episode of the latest season. This year's, which is season 10. Now, I'm not going to sit here like Homer Simpson and talk about what I saw on TV, but there is something in these episodes of this rather banal and cookie-cutter cop show that I think is significant and which we ought to be aware of. Briefly, as one might suspect, the cartoonish supervillain that our noble federal heroes are chasing during this segment is a wealthy white southern male who is the head of a, wait for it, multinational corporation. Now, remember when America's enemies were communists or foreign powers? Now it's all either wicked evil Muslims or wicked evil corporations headed by white males in suits who back the Republicans. Now, by the way, this alleged evil white male CEO who's plotting to blow up the world is played by a Jewish actor named Richard Schiff, and he really does look evil and sinister. You should have seen him in The West Wing. Okay, at the end of Season 9, the evil cartoonish white male, but he's really a Jew corporate supervillain, blows up the NCIS headquarters, and one of the suits in the show comes into the room, and he announces in a dramatic voice, "I've just spoken to the president, and he has given the order to terminate this individual with extreme prejudice." In other words, the president of the United States, on this TV show, has just given the order to kill an American citizen without arrest or trial, as he now has the legal power to do in real life, under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2011. And it's not a dark-skinned foreign Muslim on foreign soil. It's a character who is American-born and right here. The sequence of events in these episodes is given as May, June, and July of 2012, which, so far as I can recall, the show has never done before. In other words, the producers of the show want us to know that this is 2012 and President Barack Hussein Obama that we're talking about, not something that they're blaming on Bush. All of Episode 1, Season 10, is about NCIS and the FBI joining forces to track down one native-born white male American and kill him without trial, and how wonderful and heroic this is. Never mind the fact that he's a cartoonish supervillain and he's been blowing things up. The fact is that this is America, and that is precisely what's not supposed to happen in this country. Remember, Constitution, rule of law, does the Magna Carta ring a bell? The king isn't supposed to be able to say off with his head and someone is put to death. That's actually been illegal even since the Middle Ages in England, since the Magna Carta was signed in 1215. And it established the rule of law, which everyone, including the king himself, is supposed to be subject to. No more. Eventually, the hero of the show tracks down the supervillain in his own former home and stabs him to death with a knife in the gut, thus carrying out a perfectly legal presidential order, if you accept that the President of the United States has the right to order somebody stabbed to death in his own living room, which is where this happened. Okay, yeah, I know this is a television show we're talking about here, and it's not real. But the message that the Hollywood media seems to want to convey here is that arbitrary murder of American citizens by the president isn't really such a bad thing, since, after all, the guy's a southern white male and he's rich, and therefore he's got to be evil and wicked and racist, because he won't share all his money with nigger welfare mammies and families of illegal aliens, right? Just like the last season of 24 showed us all how wonderful it was that Jack Bauer and Chloe O'Brien had all these wonderful drones flying around in the sky with surveillance cameras to make sure that the government's benevolent gaze can watch over us all and protect us from the bad guys. It's almost as if the regime is beginning the process of preparing us, hardening us, and desensitizing us to the fact that Barry can now legally sign a piece of paper and have somebody arbitrarily murdered, or maybe stabbed and beaten to death in his home so it looks like an ordinary crime and the feds don't get embarrassed. National security considerations or whatever. It really looks to me from that show that that's what the general thrust of the idea is, and since I don't watch television, God only knows how many other shows and subtle media tricks out there are being used to slowly inoculate us to the idea that the president can have people murdered, and that's a good thing. Now, don't be too surprised if during the next 4 years, some people who oppose the dictatorship turn up dead or maybe just plain missing, since the Defense Authorization Act also legalizes abduction and indefinite detention in offshore facilities like Guantanamo Bay, or those secret CIA prisons in Bulgaria and Romania. The following is a kind of excerpt from something Gretchen the Librarian sent in a few weeks ago. I won't play her theme music because this clip is so short.
Good evening, comrades. Suddenly, doing book reviews seems rather superfluous in a way, or rather beside the point. I got to go to the polls on Thursday and really saw the mudslide. You know, in a way, I'm glad it worked out the way it did because, as some others have said, it really takes away any illusion that some might have had if the election had gone differently. You know, lately I've been thinking about the job situation and how difficult it is to find jobs, and I always used to think that one should look for a job in the homeland before going. One should find some sort of suitable employment and go to some sort of a job situation or an apartment or a house. You should have some solid idea of your destination and your goal. And, of course, you need a place to live. There's no question. But I'm starting to think that people should just go to the homeland whether they have a job or not. Because based on my research on the internet, let's say that you apply for a job somewhere in the homeland. You apply on the net. And more often than not, that kind of application ends up being rejected because even though there is all of this internet and all these ways to apply for jobs remotely, the fact is that when you apply for a job that's maybe like 2,000 miles away, you really get hired. And frankly, there's a lot of competition for jobs today anyway, but I was reading some internet commentary and there was an employment placement professional who said that really they hire people that they know, and they don't know you if you're in New Jersey. They're not going to know you in Idaho or something. So maybe it's better to just go. Maybe stay with a friend. I'm starting to think that's the better strategy. Have some savings. Try to save as much money as you can and just head out. Because, honestly, waiting for a job, it just seems like it's never going to happen. I mean, I've applied for several jobs. I haven't gotten anything, and I've heard stories of people who are in the same boat who have applied for maybe hundreds of jobs and haven't gotten anything, and waiting around just seems like you'd wait forever. So, really, those are my thoughts, and honestly, I think I'm right. I think all of this applying for jobs, I think it can be very deceptive. So that's what I'm thinking of today, and I hope you'll give that some thought. So thank you for listening.
Everybody I know who has simply said nuts with it, sold what they could, and packed all their stuff into a pickup or a U-Haul trailer and just come out here, everybody like that that I'm aware of was able to get a job and get settled in. I can't think of anyone who has come out here without a job who was not in housing and employed within 3 to 4 weeks. Now, sometimes these jobs are not exactly optimal career opportunities, true, and it's not something that you want to spend the rest of your life doing. But if you come out here with a certain minimum of resources and cash in your pocket, enough to get a cheap apartment and pay the security deposit and get the utilities turned on, and enough money to live on for a couple of months, even if living means eating rice and beans and sleeping on a mattress on the floor, then you'll get something and you'll be fine. Now, I've always found it ironic that the thing that most people claim to worry most about, employment, has so far turned out to be one of the quickest problems to solve in real life. Seems to me I haven't gone medieval on your ass for a while. Now, this first music track is from an old British folk singing group from the 1970s called Pentangle, and the song is a variation on one I've played on here before in the Appalachian Mountain version. Remember a number I played on here about a year ago called Oh, the Wind and Rain by Jerry Garcia and the Grateful Dead? That was a much later version of the same song, which is called in the Child Ballads The Cruel Sister. That seems to be many centuries old, and it appears all over the British Isles before it was brought to America. Now, the plot is always some variation on the same thing. Two sisters have a cat fight over a boyfriend. One of them pushes the other into a river or off a cliff into the sea, something like that. The dead girl's corpse gets fished out by a minstrel or a fiddle player or some other kind of musician, who then makes either a harp or a fiddle or a lute or something of the sort out of her assorted body parts. Her hair's the strings, her finger bones or fiddle pegs, that kind of thing. And then he takes the instrument into the other sister's wedding feast, where she's getting married to the boyfriend, and it starts playing by itself and accusing the wicked sister of the murder. Now, sometimes the bridegroom pulls out his sword or his bowie knife or whatever and kills the bride, cuts off her head, whatever, and sometimes not. So, it's got everything. Sex, murder, and the supernatural. This comes from the days before National Enquirer, but people still wanted the same type of entertainment. Now, this is one of those really interesting old ballads where you get the impression that somewhere, sometime, probably about 1,000 years or so ago, something happened that became the basis for this song. I really wonder what the real life facts were, but of course we'll never know.
Yeah.
In June of 2010, North Idaho attorney Edgar J. Steele was arrested by the FBI on false charges of allegedly hiring a hitman to murder his wife and mother-in-law. The alleged assassin was a man named Larry Fairfax, an FBI informer who was inserted into Steele's home posing as a handyman in order to spy on the Steele family until he saw the opportunity to help the Bureau destroy an outspoken critic of the dictatorship. While he was working there, Fairfax proceeded to help himself to large stashes of silver coins and bullion that the Steeles were keeping on their property in anticipation of a Federal Reserve currency crash brought on by Barack Obama's incompetence. The final whereabouts of that silver seems to be something of a mystery. Apparently, the FBI allowed Fairfax to keep at least some of it as a kind of bonus or reparations for the annoyance and inconvenience of having to spend 16 months in a minimum security federal prison in the service of the Bureau. The basis of Edgar Steele's conviction were audio files fabricated by FBI technicians, supposedly discussions between himself and Fairfax about murder for hire. These conversations appear even to a layman who first hears them to sound strained, stilted, unnatural, and obviously doctored at the key points and phrases. The Steele tapes were not only forgeries, apparently they weren't even very good ones. At Steele's trial, two international audio engineering experts who were prepared to state categorically, for the record, that the tapes were fraudulent, were barred from testifying by a corrupt judge. The jury was never allowed to hear evidence which clearly proved Edgar Steele's innocence. The situation wasn't helped by the fact that Steele's first attorney, a federal public defender named Roger Peavin, was a raging alcoholic who at the time was being sued by three members of his own legal staff for various acts of drunken misconduct. Steele's second defense attorney, a man named Robert McAllister, on whom he and his wife Cindy expended most of their life savings, turned out to be facing disbarment for embezzling his client's money, and was in fact disbarred only weeks after Steele's conviction. Many suspect that this second attorney may have struck a deal with the government to keep himself out of prison by deliberately taking a dive in the courtroom and bungling Steele's defense. If so, it didn't work. In September of 2012, the 62-year-old McAllister was sentenced to 6 years for fraud, so there's some comfort in hoping that the bent brief may die in the same prison cell as the client he betrayed. Interestingly enough, McAllister himself was a former United States attorney and prosecutor, which gives you some idea of the typical moral character of the people in the federal judiciary. For whatever reason, McAllister's performance in the courtroom was lackluster, to say the least, and he refused to put his client on the witness stand, which always looks very bad to a jury. Needless to say, the attorney's own perilous legal situation was never explained to either Ed or Cindy Steele while the trial was going on. As icing on the cake, I've spoken to persons present in the courtroom during the trial who told me that Ed Steele, quote-unquote, looked like a zombie, confused and disoriented, and he seemed completely incoherent and disconnected from what was going on around him. The consensus of opinion was that Steele was drugged on orders from someone in the federal government to make sure that he was incapable of assisting in his own defense or even understanding what was happening to him. No one knows for sure why the federal government of the United States did this horrible thing to Edgar Steele. He must have pissed somebody off really bad, although I don't see how. Ed had announced plans to run for governor of Idaho, but he subsequently withdrew from the Idaho governor's race due to ill health. I have this horrible suspicion that the whole ghastly business may simply have been some kind of grotesque experiment on the part of the FBI simply to see how far they could go and how much they could get away with in arresting and destroying critics of the dictatorship. Edgar Steele is being held, we think, in the Victorville facility, which is well known throughout the federal system as a kind of toilet where human beings are flushed away. Among other things, the water supply in the prison is known to be contaminated with carcinogens and toxic waste, which facilitates the decline in health of those federal prisoners whom the government wishes to hear no more of. Victorville is notorious as an end-of-the-line destination. Once the gates clang shut there, no one leaves except in a body bag. Edgar Steele has been sent there to die. And I'm now going to play for you a part of a podcast that Edgar Steele made back in 2005.
My name is Edgar J. Steele. The following is entitled Pogo Was Right and was released on May 31st, 2005. The introductory quotes for the article: our enemies are innovative and resourceful, and so are we. They never stop thinking about new ways to harm our country and our people, and neither do we. That, of course, was our own inimitable president, George W. Bush, allegedly misspeaking at a bill signing ceremony on August 5th, 2004. Second and last quote for this week: we have met the enemy, and he is us. Mouthed by Pogo, the beloved cartoon creation of Walt Kelly. America's president recently addressed the graduating class at the U.S. Naval Academy at Annapolis, Maryland. George Bush spoke glowingly of the progress in his war on terrorism. You know, apparently he has no access to internet news sources. Bush said, "We are taking the fight to the enemy abroad so we do not have to face them here at home." And he received a burst of applause. He also noted that the best way to protect our citizens is to stay on the offensive. More applause, at least according to the official White House transcript. Well, let me tell you a little bit about what's going on here at home, meanwhile, that seems to deserve such protection. Recently, high school students in Goose Creek, South Carolina, received a surprise visit from the local drug task force. Police had been monitoring students via cameras mounted throughout the school and thought they saw suspicious conduct. CBS News quoted Goose Creek Police Lieutenant David Ahrens as saying, "They know where the cameras are. If they stand directly under them, the cameras don't look directly down." Well, duh. Lack of visible proof of innocent conduct via Big Brother cam apparently now provides probable cause to believe a crime is being committed. Did Lieutenant Ahrens visit the school to peek beneath the cameras for himself? No. Did the police take it up with parents or the school board? No. Did they search the lockers? Well, yes, they did, but only after mounting a full-on tactical squad raid, during which students were forced to lie flat while police waved their guns threateningly and forcibly searched all kids present and all lockers. 14 children who didn't move quickly enough to suit the police were handcuffed and made to kneel down in the hallway. No drugs ever were found, despite a phalanx of trained dogs set loose in the school's hallways. Now, can't you just see Lieutenant Ahrens, glued to the monitors down at the squad room right now, growling, spittle dripping off his lip, vowing to catch those criminals in the act sooner or later? This sort of police state tactic increasingly becomes commonplace throughout a desensitized and obedient America, already manhandled and abused at airport check-in counters. What truly was remarkable about the video released to the local TV station was the obvious presence of a uniformed military officer at the South Carolina school raid, who never was identified and about whom not one word has been said in the controlled media. Ever since all those women and children were murdered in Waco, Texas, by their own out-of-control government, we repeatedly have seen American military men showing up at domestic confrontations. This is the same military, by the way, that George Bush just told cheering Annapolis Naval Academy graduates is taking the fight to the enemy abroad so we don't have to face them here at home. Indeed. The best way to protect our citizens is to stay on the offensive, said Mr. Bush, don't forget. Well, he certainly is being offensive, and in every sense of the word. Meanwhile, back in the halls of America's Congress, U.S. House Judiciary Committee Chairman James Sensenbrenner, Republican, Wisconsin, wants to force every American to become an informant by making it a jailable offense not to rat out others, even other family members. Congressman Sensenbrenner has introduced House Resolution 1528, which itself asks to be cited as the, quote, Safe Access to Drug Treatment and Child Protection Act of 2005, close quote. Tough to argue with a bill carrying a title like that, isn't it? Well, here's what that bill requires. If you learn about drug offenses, you must report them within 24 hours and provide, quote, full assistance in the investigation, apprehension, and prosecution, close quote, of those involved. What does that mean? Well, If you find a joint in your son's sock drawer, you'll have to call the police. Or if you overhear your daughter ask a friend in rehab to get her an ecstasy tablet for an upcoming rave party, H.R. 1528 says that you go to jail if you don't report your daughter to the police right then and there. What's more, H.R. 1528 mandates 5-year prison terms for a great many new offenses, including offering a joint to or asking for a controlled substance from anybody who ever has been in drug treatment. 10 years for parents with substance abuse problems who commit certain drug-related offenses at home, even if they are alone at the time. You know, the only thing that America's much-ballyhooed war on drugs ever has done is create more drug criminals and prison inmates, usually out of otherwise solid, law-abiding American citizens. Similarly, all that America's war on terror is doing is creating more terrorists. It may have been safe for Americans to travel abroad before, but it certainly isn't safe today, nor will it be tomorrow. And the mentality has seeped all through society, as exemplified by so many recent and outlandish police interventions in America's public schools. And the police seem to be in league with the military at that, as if America, who leads the military both now and throughout all of history in the percentage of its population behind bars, needs to make criminals out of still more of her good citizens. Recall that shortly after 9/11, George Bush told us that Arabs armed with box cutters and no flying experience commandeered 3 jumbo jets and flew them with air show precision into 3 buildings because, quote, they hate our freedom, close quote. Well, he was partially correct. Those responsible for 9/11 and other atrocities, both here and abroad, do hate our freedom. And we do need to be afraid of them. Problem is, they are us. Our own government, actually. Otherwise, why would our own government be taking away our freedoms at such a rapid pace? Why are they so afraid of us and in such a hurry to regiment us, lock us down, and throw so many of us into jail? What is going to happen that they need such tight control of us? What exactly is it that they plan next to do to us? We have nobody to blame but ourselves. We may not have elected them, such a sham has America's electoral process become, but we allow them to continue to rule over us. An earlier America would have seen such leaders tarred, feathered, and ridden out of town on a rail. A more responsible population today spontaneously would form leaderless mobs and drag them from their plush Capitol Hill and Wall Street offices to languish in the prison cells to which they consign our fellow citizens for the slightest offense. And worse. Osama bin Laden, in one of his earliest communiques, justified the targeting of ordinary American citizens by pointing out that we have both the responsibility and the collective ability to replace our leaders, yet we do nothing while they plunder the world in our name. He was right. What's more, Pogo was right when Walt Kelly used him to say that we have met the enemy, and he is us. Chicken Little was right, too. Like Winston Smith, George Orwell's leading character from his masterpiece 1984, Pogo and Chicken Little were characters years ahead of their time. Their time now has come, sad to say. But then, so has New America's. New America, an idea whose time has come. My name is Edgar J. Steele. Thanks for listening. Visit my website at www.conspiracypenpal.com for other articles, just like this one.
So far, all legal appeals of the Edgar Steele case have been rejected without comment. No appeals court, including the Supreme Court, will even hear them. Edgar Steele has been held virtually incommunicado now for almost a year. His mail is simply disappearing with no response. When he was first admitted to Victorville, he was restricted to writing 5 letters per month. He was given brief access to a prison email system called Carlinks, but no one has heard from him for approximately 5 months, and there have been no updates to the official blog or Facebook page since September the 18th. I've finally been able to get someone close to the family to talk to me on a limited basis, and it would appear that I was correct in reporting that absolutely crushing pressure has been brought on Cindy Steele to be quiet, which I don't want to go into since she's still trying to cope with this latest round of cruelty and oppression from the regime.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. This is Andy Donner, and I'm here today to do a little housekeeping and maybe help out new listeners if I can. I'm recording this on the 15th of November, and while I despise the comment, chat, and message board functionality on many websites, I do try to at least keep up with the chatter on the party website. In response to today's RFN episode, I see I was addressed in a comment from someone who is probably new to the Northwest independence idea. I say probably because their question could easily be real, since the concerns it brings up are seemingly real concerns, but there's a hint of disdain in it, and it could easily be a heckle, too. Since we have quite a few new listeners, according to the site stats Mr. Covington sends out, I'm going to answer it as if it were real for the benefit of most of the audience, and then I'm going to answer the heckle also for the benefit of the entire audience. This person asked, "As for migrating, I'm not convinced yet it's a good idea. For one thing, migrating is costly when it comes to quitting one's job, abandoning one's house, and moving one's family up to the Pacific Northwest. Question: just how many bona fide white nationalists have joined the Pacific Northwest? I'd like to know, with no equivocation." I'm honestly not deliberately equivocating here, but I need to point out a couple of things wrong with the question. I'm not at all trying to mock this person, but everyone should take note how useless the internet can be at times. Firstly, what is a bona fide white nationalist? Is it someone you approve of? Someone famous in the movement? Or is it a genuine committed white nationalist individual? This, more so than any other, is where the ambiguity in the questioner's meaning and intent creeps in, and for obvious reasons. Secondly, what is meant by joining the Pacific Northwest, or rather the Northwest Front, and when are you referring to? The idea of the Northwest Imperative has been around much, much longer than the Northwest Front, and we're just the latest bunch to back up the idea. I'll answer this one after I deal with the easy matter of your migration concern. Migration itself isn't the point. For the benefit of new listeners, the Northwest Front is a group of white men and women who live in the Pacific Northwest and work towards the creation of an independent, all-white nation in this region of the world so that we may secure the existence of our people and a future for white children. Recent political events in the United States of America have hopefully forced a few more pairs of white eyes open to the racial situation in the world, and with any luck, they're hearing my voice now. The past several decades have seen nothing but failure, despite some valiant efforts here and there to reverse the extinction of our white race, and now things are so bad we're forced to a last-ditch strategy of ejecting the federal government from part of what used to be a white man's country, or else we face extinction the world over. Our race desperately needs the better elements of the white nationalist community to relocate to our region and meet up with the Northwest Front to begin implementing the Butler Plan, which you can read about on the party website. In fact, spend quite a bit of time reading the entire party website and then get your hands on the Northwest novel series by Harold Covington. All of your deep ideological and strategic questions are answered therein. If you've decided to accept your responsibility, use the contact form on the website to get in touch with the party for an introductory packet. Migration is how we will build the basis of a fighting revolutionary party to bring about a situation wherein the party is capable of seizing this territory and claiming state power so our race may survive. I migrated here, and it certainly wasn't easy. I didn't have to leave a house, true, but I did leave plenty behind. When the time comes, it's a blessing to do so because you didn't really need those things to begin with. It was expensive, yes, but worth it, since this is one of the last remaining functional parts of America. There are jobs here, and if you have sufficient earning potential to acquire your own home, you'll do just fine here, if not better than where you are now. Migration is a good idea, though not for your own sake, but for our whole race's benefit. Migration isn't luxurious, no, not by a long shot, but it is the right thing to do. As for the issue of how many bona fide white nationalists have joined the Northwest Front, I'll answer the question as honestly as I can. First, I'm by no means going to give you a number. That's informing, and informing is one of the things a white nationalist ought not do. Having said that, I'll assume, for the sake of the whole listenership, especially the newer listeners, you're asking about how many people have made the migration or otherwise support us in the homeland. As honestly as I can tell you, there are pitiful few of us, but we do have a few more every year. Harold often laments the fact that we ought to be a lot further along than we are, and he's certainly right. If you listen to the prior Radio Free Northwest episodes, you'll get a good lesson in the defect of the white character. Now, I need to address the possibility the question is a heckle. I really doubt it, since the first part of the question about migration is a pretty common one, but we've had our fair share of goo-boo, and it's not likely to stop, no matter how popular in the movement we become. I'll ask again about the definition of bona fide. What is that exactly? If you mean how many people have made the migration, then I'll say 100% of all bona fide white nationalists, since a bona fide nationalist would actually act on their beliefs in accordance with a plan to bring about the survival of our race. If bona fide means a leader of the movement, or even a distinguished movement personality, then I really can't give you a solid answer, since there have been a lot of movement leaders over the years who have upped stakes and moved here. Think Pastor Butler for a start. Many other white nationalists have sanctified our homeland by giving up their lives here. As for the standard movement leadership crowd of today, I would also have to say 100% of the bona fide nationalists have participated. The rest of the movement is dead set against allowing discussion of solutions which involve actually doing something. Even the Southern nationalists don't actually have a plan. If someone would like to dispute that, please provide the party with an example of such a plan. In fact, the first Northwest novel, The Hill of the Ravens, has a scene where the old man character goes on a rant about the current and past political movement leadership. I'm really tempted to read that rant here, but it's a bit more material than a new person would want right away. If you're genuinely curious about the state of the movement, contact the party via the website and ask for a document called A Brief History of the White Nationalist Movement. I hope that's enough of an answer for you.
I'd just like to add a few quick comments to Andy's piece here. Now, I get emails and inquiries from a lot of people who want to know exactly how many Northwest migrants there are. Now, sometimes this is simply an idle curiosity question. Sometimes it's somebody fishing around to see if there is a crowd up here that he can hide in. And on that subject, once we can assure white people that there is indeed a herd here that they can be part of, and that they can hide in the crowd, we will experience a rush of new settlers, because that's what a lot of white people are looking for. They're seeking strength and safety in numbers, and that is not an entirely illegitimate desire. Indeed, it's one reason we want to build actual communities here, so that eventually we can have at least pockets of safety in the homeland before the main event begins. Sometimes, of course, the reason for asking about, or usually arrogantly demanding, a precise number of migrants is less creditable and more sinister. Either it's someone who's deliberately trying to interfere with the migration process and cause confusion and demoralization for whatever reason, or else I think some of these people are just flat-out police spies or FBI undercovers or working for various hostile NGOs like the ADL and the SPLC. Now, in answer to the question, though, I will tell you that there isn't any answer. I don't know myself how many Northwest migrants there are. Nobody does. In the first place, most migration to the Northwest homeland is what we call organic migration, by white people who are fleeing from the rest of the country, especially from California, for racial reasons as well as economic ones, but who have never even heard of me or the Northwest novels or the Northwest Front. Now, these folks will use code words like good schools and low crime and a clean environment and a better economy, but everybody knows that they're looking to get away from the niggers and the Mexicans. And in the case of California, they're trying to get away from a state government that has turned into a socialist monster that's eating small business alive through taxation and desperately trying to kill the goose that lays the golden eggs by seizing the last privately held wealth in the state from middle-aged and elderly white people in order to support a full-time state legislature and a $40 million a day welfare habit. As to how many of those there are, I've got no idea, but it's a lot. I think that when the time comes for the Northwest Independence Movement to make its move up here, most of our support won't come from the overtly racial migrants that we've been bringing in, but from these organic migrants who understand that they fled once to get away from Obama and the dictatorship and the mud flow. It didn't work. The disease and the contamination has followed them, and they can't run away anymore. They have to stand and fight. Now, on the other hand, sometimes I don't know when I've been successful. Sometimes people will get in touch with me for a while, and I'll send them their party material, and then they'll go dark on me, and I don't know what's happened to them. For all I know, they've just lost interest and wandered off. And then all of a sudden, months or years later, I hear from this person again saying, "Hi, Harold, here I am in Idaho or South Oregon or even in the Puget area, and I love it." Sometimes they've been home for months, and they haven't even checked in yet. That's another thing. There are a lot of people who come home to the Northwest, and that's all they do. They settle here, they make new lives for themselves, and they live them. And they have little or nothing to do with the party after they arrive, which is fine. The first step towards revolution is the actual physical act of transplanting racially aware whites from the rest of the continent here to the Pacific Northwest. And right now, that's what I'm concerned with. When the time does come for my successor to jump up on the picnic table, wearing his cape and flourishing his saber aloft, and lead the mob to storm the Bastille, or whatever the Northwest equivalent of that may turn out to be, we're going to need local support from the people who live here. Well, that's our main strategic objective right now. To change the political demographics in the Pacific Northwest, both through the importation of racially conscious white people from the rest of the country, and also by educating and converting the woodchucks, the white people who already live here, especially poor and working class whites, since the middle class will be mostly concerned about their money and not their race. Now, the standard answer that I always give when people ask me how many Northwest settlers there are is, I tell them, more than we had this time last year, but not as many as we're going to have this time next year. And I'm not lying, it's the truth. Okay, we haven't had any white rock music on here for quite some time, but one of our listeners recommended that I check out a Swedish black metal band called Sabaton. Now, this is a song about the SS on the Eastern Front, and it's called Ghost Division.
Yeah.
If our race is to have any hope of surviving, we must unlock the secret of why we continue to do nothing. Our group behavior is extremely illogical. Every other persecuted minority in history has survived by banding together and seeking safety in numbers. The classic example of this, although maybe a distasteful one to us, is that of the Jews. Contrary to legend, in most cases, Dark Ages and medieval rulers did not lock the Jews up into ghettos. The Jews themselves chose to live all together in a group, in fact insisted on it, and their rabbis laid down all kinds of rules and codes of conduct, which you can still find in the Talmud regarding how and when and under what circumstances Jews may interact with Gentiles. Always in business or economic contexts, never social or religious. The object was to keep contact to a minimum and make sure that the Jews maintained their separate racial and ethnic identity, no matter where they were living. So why don't we all band together here in the Northwest or anywhere else for that matter? This is what we have to find out and fix. I think a large part of it are our two old friends, cowardice and apathy. Now, I spoke about cowardice last week, but I got sidetracked, and so I didn't get into the major part about how just plain, don't give a damn apathy plays a great role in our refusal to do what we all know we need to be doing. White people are socially conditioned from birth, of course, to be completely passive. The Jews like us like that. Proactive and vigorous and inquisitive white people tend to get ideas into their head that they shouldn't. Herd animals who do nothing but consume and produce allow the Jews and the faceless men in the suits of our own race to reap profit from us in various ways. Grazing cattle and sheep are generally pretty apathetic about what goes on around them. But beyond that, and I've said this before, the problem is that we simply don't believe that it's possible to change anything. I've lived in other times and places, and so I know that it is possible, but most of you don't, and I get that. This is what lies behind the constant, more or less, demands that I get via email to the effect that I must, quote-unquote, show you something before you will make any kind of move. Now, most of you are what you are. You're consumers who are comparison shopping for some kind of white nationalist involvement. And that's what you've been conditioned to be from birth. Like good shoppers, you come to me and demand that I guarantee a result or your money back. That I guarantee bang for your buck. That I make sure anything the NF offers has training wheels and all kinds of safety features, and that there's no chance you'll get hurt or inconvenienced in any way. Of course, I can't guarantee these things. No one in the movement can. I'm just honest enough to admit it. There is no question in my mind that if somehow or other the Northwest Front could put together and trot out for public display a finished product, a bandwagon for white people to jump on, then they'd be lining up. That's the daunting task that every movement group faces, not just ours. Everybody demands to see that bandwagon rolling down the street before they'll jump on. But the trouble is that the lack of the old alpha gene, the absence of genuine pioneers who are willing to go first in anything, has made it virtually impossible for any white nationalist effort to succeed. You listen to other podcasts and other groups, and you'll hear their public spokesmen complaining about exactly the same character issues that we do. The flaw is not only in the movement and its various approaches. The flaw is in all of us as a people, because we are what the Jews have made us. Timid, frightened, hesitant, introspective, self-centered consumer animals. Rare indeed is the white American who can completely rise above that upbringing. I know it still turns and bites me in the ass every now and then. So, what do we do? In a way, I kind of wish I was 17 or 18 again and I had it all to do over. I think what I'd do, besides get myself a viable trade so that I could always make a living, is that I would take a more spiritual approach. Do like L. Ron Hubbard and found my own religion for white people to try and repair some of the psychic damage that's been done to white people. But that ship sailed long ago, so I'm kind of stuck with secular Northwest nationalism. And you know that can actually be a pretty good substitute for religion. A mystical belief in the freedom of a people in a new land. It's motivated a lot of revolutionaries prior to this. And what we have to do is give white people something to believe in again. We don't really thrive as herd animals, you know. It's not in our nature. We need belief in something greater than ourselves, something to strive for. A new nation on the face of the earth would fill that bill quite nicely. It has in the past, often enough. This is Runrig. If memory serves, we haven't run down NF contact procedures on this show for a while, so let's give that another shot. Now, the following is an email that I get quite often in one form or another. Dear HAC, hi, I'm so-and-so from Canada. I was told that you have an important operation you are doing. I was referred by thus and such. I want to find out more about this operation you got going, so if you can please reply to this soon. Thus and such is convinced that you need to get in touch, as I could be of use. I would like information on this. I am interested in the Northwest Initiative. Thank you for your time. Okay, I usually reply something along this line. Dear so-and-so. Okay, first step. I need a name and a mailing address so that I can send you a Northwest handbook, commonly called the White Book. You can email me at nwnet@earthlink.net or use the contact form on the website at northwestfront.org. Now, if you're in Canada or overseas and you are willing to read a book on a computer, I'll send you a free PDF copy to save me the expense and the effort of filling out all the stupid customs forms. Now, we should have a national organizer to be doing all this with the aid of a professional staff, and I should be sitting in the background churning out all the books and audios and videos and creative stuff, also with the aid of a staff. But if wishes were horses, then beggars would ride. Now, someday, enough of you will step forward to make this an actual real-world movement of live human beings. We're getting there, and we're closer to existing in the non-internet real world than anybody else in white nationalism. But we still have a ways to go yet. Now, that's why I need you people to get your butts up here and get with the program. Now, white books and the sample copies of Northwest Observer and other literature items that you will receive are free, although if you wish to help defray the cost, I certainly won't say no. But the main thing is that you need to sit down and read this manual and the other literature I'll send you and understand its import. I repeat, I need a name and address to send them to. If you're too paranoid to send me that, then get back in touch when you've got your head together. Anything worth doing politically contains a modicum of risk, and the price of your involvement with the NF is that you're going to have to step out from behind the computer at least a little. The relationship we're going to hopefully begin to build is based on trust. It has to be. And if you don't trust us, we don't trust you. The address you give us can be a post office box or a PMB, And the name doesn't even have to be yours. Just make sure that the post office will deliver mail to that address under that name. There's nothing I hate more than having handbooks and whatnot sent back marked addressee unknown because some mighty internet Aryan warrior went into a cold sweat at the last minute and tried to run back into hiding by giving some kind of weird or incomplete address or stupid pseudonym like Adolf Wessel or Horst Eichmann, some name that the PO hasn't been notified to deliver to. This is your first test. I need you to have the balls to step out from behind the computer for a moment, and frankly, 95% of our mighty Aryan warriors lack even that rudimentary physical courage. Now, let me be straight with you. If you're too timid and frightened to give out some kind of mailing address so that you can receive printed material, which is vitally important to your future and the future of your race, then that tells me something I need to know about you. It tells me that you are too timid and frightened to make a revolutionary. Revolutionaries have to learn to strike a balance between boldness when necessary and caution when necessary. We are never going to win this thing with people who are frightened of their mailman. Now, the next step is to start talking about your migration, when you will come here to the homeland. But you need to get over that first hump first and make that first tiny little baby step out from behind the computer. A journey of 1,000 miles begins with but a single step, and I've just told you what yours has to be. Okay, for reasons I won't get into, I need to wrap this episode up a bit early and get it uploaded onto the site. So that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98104. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Andaban. Freedom.